This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DeFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 59 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe. You know, I say this all the time, but they mean a lot. So the more you guys do that would be great. If you're enjoying the show, just drop one. I would really appreciate it. And obviously, always hit me back with feedback, anything, you know, comments, recommendations, questions, you know, all that good stuff, as always. In light of that, talking about the some previous episodes, we had Eric Sim this past week. Eric's episode has been just really applauded and loved, and I think part of that is his real, the nature in which he says things is very real and very straightforward, and he combines that with a perspective of someone who played baseball up into the AAA level, went to, you know, started out growing up in South Korea, moved to Canada, came to the States for junior college, made his way to University of South Florida. He's had a pretty crazy journey. And he combines that perspective with not only, you know, how raw he is and how straight to the point he is and authentic he is, but he also, has a great perspective of someone who's, you know, working. He's not playing anymore, but he's working his way back to things that he did when he was playing, getting in better shape, throwing over 90 miles an hour. He is very strong and has a pretty intense training regimen that he goes through. So we broke a lot of that stuff down, and it's been a very popular episode thus far in the first week. So check that out if you haven't yet. Episode 57, we had Michael Boyle, come on, a veteran and legend in the strength and conditioning community in every sense of the word. Check out his episode. You know, if you're looking for anything when it comes to getting into the industry and the business of strength and conditioning, you know, principles and, you know, different topics, whether it's in-season training, sprint training, you know, being careful when looking at research studies and, you know, the type of research studies you should look for and everything like that. So check that out if you haven't yet. And then episode 57, Zan Barksdale. Oh, wait, that might have screwed my number. Yeah, I'm sorry. Episode 56 with Zan Barksdale. Zan being a guy that has, you know, climbed the ranks of baseball coaching and played at Ole Miss at a high level, has experience with USA Baseball, very successful business. We're talking a lot of business with him, a bunch of different things related to strength conditioning, baseball, all type of stuff like that. So you guys definitely want to check that one out. Today's guest, Bob Alejo, not really much to say about him. He's pretty self-explanatory. His name says a lot, but Bob spent quite a long time with the Oakland A's in the MLB. He's been at UCLA and he is now, I'm going to screw up his title. So I'm not going to say what his official title is, but he basically acts as, the head of high performance. I'm going to say in terms of, you know, helping make hires in the, performance department, whether it's strength coaches, athletic trainers, things like that, at Cal Northridge, CSUN. Hold on. I'm feeling like an idiot. I'm going to look it up. Cal Northridge. I always see the abbreviation and I screw it up anyway. Yes, California State University, Northridge, CSUN. So Bob is over there and he's helping make the right hires for the performance department, someone with experience and knowledge and expert in the industry, ensuring that the coaches that are coming on are qualified and not only qualified, but bringing about a method of communication and a symbiotic relationship amongst all facets of the performance department, whether it's skill coaches working with the strength coaches working with the athletic trainers, things like that. Every department has an identified role. He's responsible in bringing those people in and out and, you know, mediating over decisions made in those departments and really giving those departments the power to do what they need to do. So Bob, not only with his wealth of experience at the professional level, but with what he does now at the college level. And, you know, we're going to talk a lot about this high performance model, you know, the benefits of it, where it's going, what it comprises, and kind of how it's going to be continuing to make itself to the forefront of college and professional athletics. And then basically We're getting into some important topics regarding the core and core stability and what that is, and then also some validated characteristics differentiating expert and competent strength and conditioning coaches. So a lot of good stuff we talked about. He's awesome, similar to what I said about Mike Boyle, just a veteran and legend in the industry and someone you're going to definitely want to listen to. So I hope you guys enjoy this one. It was really fun having Bob on. As always, enjoy. Please rate, review, and subscribe. I'm becoming like a parrot saying that. I say it all the time, but really helps me out. So if you don't mind, drop one of those. Enjoy the talk with Bob. I know you guys are going to love it. Until next time, peace. All right, everyone. Excited to have on Bob Alejo. Bob, thanks so much for your time. Excited to have you.
Oh, wait, man. Nothing better than spending the morning with Jerry talking about good stuff.
I appreciate you coming on. As I told you, so for the listeners, we just talked a couple minutes before we got started. And one of the things that I've been really kind of dying to talk to Bob about, especially because of what he does currently in his career, is the high performance model. It's been like a hot topic amongst strength coaches on Twitter, especially. And it's something I think that's like very important to discuss, and why, you know, things need to really move more in the direction of the high performance model. But I guess the first thing is maybe you kind of explain what it is for the listener, kind of wondering what the hell I'm talking about. And you know, then we'll go from there.
Well, I think it's simple everywhere you go, really. I mean, I you know, now that I'm older and I've done enough, it's really, not surprising to me how very simple all this stuff really is. So for me, the high performance model is I'm in charge of getting a collaborative effort out of sports medicine, what we have, right? Sports medicine, strength conditioning, sports nutrition, sports psychology. In a bigger model, there might be sports science and a separate maybe rehab unit. But what I got to do is I have to get them to collaboratively produce the best healthcare and performance delivery system for the athlete. So those entities report to me. So I'm looking at how do I get things into the best possible format for the athletes, and therefore, you know, supporting the coaches in their quest to have great seasons, which are, you know, essentially linked to healthy seasons.
Yeah, for sure. You made a great point to wrap up that statement there about being healthy. I think, you know, from what I've talked to Kurt Hester a little bit about this, you know, on his show when he was on, and basically, you know, the idea that the collaborative effort of, you know, he was saying in the ideal world, like the ATCs are in the same room as the strength coaches. Yeah. They're all working together, and they're basically running the show in terms of like telling the sport coaches, like, hey, this is what we're doing, and we're making sure we're on the same page so that the athletes aren't overworked. They're ready. Like, everything's really just kind of like a well-oiled machine. And I think you bringing up the injury part of it is huge, because that's like the single, I think, biggest benefit of this. Well, I mean, there's a couple, but if you're actually, sure, if you're talking about the actual, like, you know, application and the athlete specifically and keeping them healthy away from like the administrative side and hiring and everything, because we'll talk about that. But the health part of it is huge, because I think in my experience, especially, the biggest thing I see with athletes getting injured is overwork. And the overwork part comes from the fact that there's not like enough communication between the sport coaches and the strength coaches, because maybe some are doing extra that they shouldn't be doing if they had known, you know, what the other department was doing with the athletes. I think that's huge.
Well, it is, and I look at it a little bit differently, and I've been, you know, publicly critical of those who talk about, you know, looking at loads and workloads and all that, and saying, hey, you know, prevent injury. I go the other way. I say we're trying to produce performance. So, you know, and a good program that, again, comes out of a collaborative effort is about performance. And if you're performing, you're not injured. And as we've said before, kind of flippantly, you know, amongst all of us, you know, good training is injury prevention. And that'll be the last time you hear me say the word prevention, because I don't believe in it. It's not true. Never has been. Mm-hmm. Injury management. But is good training. There's a little bit more to it than that. But in the end, it's about creating good performance parameters so that we can get health. And yes, load's important, but I don't find that the workload is too much in some instances. But what you do find is what you spoke to a little bit earlier minutes ago is that the loads that are being implemented, either through athletic training, through strength conditioning, through sport coaches, they're not all talking to each other about it. So it may not be that it's too much. It's just that it's not in sync.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You made a point one time, I remember. It really changed my whole outlook on this entire. I think it was a Simply Faster article. It was about, you referenced your time with the Oakland A's about how a big reason that you found that there were injuries occurring was maybe that the athletes weren't prepared enough to handle the stresses of the in season. So it's like if you're kind of, and you said, you know, not mentioning the word prevention, I'm going to mention it just in terms of like the negative implications around it. Like that sometimes if we're so focused on training, quote unquote, preventing things, we're going to cause them to happen more. Like if I'm worried about, you know, protecting and never exposing an athlete to enough stress or enough, stimuli or whatever it is, they are going to encounter it in the season maybe. And that's what's going to maybe lead to their injury, that they weren't prepared for that.
I would agree. And I look a little bit, more at workloads, and I'm not seeing a ton of overworked athletes getting hurt. I really think it's more that they're underprepared. Mm. They don't sprint enough. They don't lift heavy enough. In those instances, and you know, that's what I found to be true, especially in baseball. Baseball is a sport where I think a lot of those injuries come out of being underprepared. Even when I was with my position players during the season, I didn't see anybody else doing that. I mean, it boggles my mind. And then you talk about, oh, it's a long season, we can't lift heavy. Well, that's a bunch of crap. Of course you can lift heavy. You just have to be good at it and know how to implement it. So I really feel that not only just in normal training are we underpreparing athletes, definitely underpreparing them in the return to play protocol. Afraid to stress them. I think that's ridiculous. You know, like you're not looking at baseline data. And essentially what you're doing with these athletes that are coming back and getting ready to go back to practice, back to sport, back to play, is you're training them the same way you would do a healthy athlete. It's just that this athlete has certain limitations, and eventually they've got to get back to doing exactly what everybody else was doing, or specifically exactly what they were doing when they were healthy. And I don't see that happening enough. I certainly don't hear about it.
Yeah. Yeah, let me ask you this. You made a great point about, you know, the return to play and everything. Do you really think that, or even that you mentioned the in-season lifting, do you think that sometimes the lack of enough of, let's say, for lack of a better term, you know, keeping the foot on the gas pedal really comes down to not knowing how to implement things the right way in a, you know, responsible kind of manner? And so many people will kind of back off too much, saying like, all right, well, if I don't know really how to toe that line the right way, I'm going to just totally stay away from it because I'm afraid of hurting an athlete in their mind.
I would say you're close to 100% correct. Yeah. I mean, look, you know, oh, we got to be careful because, you know, we're going to create injury if we go too heavy. Like, well, you're definitely going to create it if you don't go heavy enough. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the old story, like, well, getting really, really strong doesn't guarantee that you're going to be able to run fast, but being really, really weak guarantees you won't. So it's one of those things, right? So you've got to be able to learn that quality. I mean, look, it all comes down to exercise physiology 1A, all of it. Everything we do comes down to that. If you don't know that, it's going to be tough to go farther than that. And when you know that you have to prepare your muscles for 100% tension at some point, because really nobody's out there injuring themselves going at 70% or even 80% or perhaps 85%. So, you know, you can only do that one way, and that's to create a load that stresses the system enough. Now, when you talk about in-season training, they say, well, I got to be careful not to go heavy in season. And I say, well, you should, especially if you haven't trained hard enough in the off-season. You can't just go ahead and do it. So again, it goes off season, in season, however you want to call the phases, comp phase, SPP, GPP, whatever. These things got to all be in sync all the time. So again, that goes back to the old periodization model. You can't miss any of those segments, number one. Number two, it has to be, again, going back to the basic concepts of training, you know, the overload theory. You get volume, frequency, and intensity. How do you alternate those to make them happen? And listen, I do understand that part about, I understand the part about, hey, I don't know how to do that, so I won't. For example, if you're not really good at teaching power cleans, you shouldn't do it. Yeah. Now, are they a great lift? Yeah, but not if they're not done correctly, so that's okay. At the same time, you can't just say, and that's it. You got to say, so what do I have to do? What can I do instead?
Yes. Yep.
So you know, again, knowing muscle physiology and what happens during specific parts of the year, you've got to come up with a strategy that allows enough stress during the season to maintain power. I shouldn't say maintain because I don't really use that either, but to keep power outputs as high as you can, to keep strength up as high as you can, to feed the formula for power output. And then the conditioning modules that go around that at the same time, not promoting soreness, not promoting fatigue through the training.
Yeah, absolutely. I you mentioned the clean. I think that's a fantastic example. It's like, well, okay, like, and I couldn't agree more with you on that. Like, if you don't know how to execute and teach it the right way, then it's probably not a good variation for you to go with, especially for your athletes. But yeah, like, what are we going to do? Like, what does the clean do for you? And now that you're not doing it, what are you going to use to get that, you know, same adaptation? So it's like,
yes,
you need to find ways. Like, again, like, there's, you know, 1,000 ways to skin a cat, as some might say, but there are some wrong ways too. Like, that just because we're going to sit here and say that, you know, there's different ways to do things doesn't mean there's not wrong ways to do them as well. So I think people get kind of blend that and blur that too much, where it's like, we take this whole, you know, there's so many different ways to get things done. Well, it's like, yeah, but you have to make sure that you don't get too flippant about that and just start doing things the wrong way just because, you know, someone told you there's not one way to do it.
Right. I'll add to that, because I've said it before. Yeah. Is there 1,000 ways to skin the cat, or whatever the term is, right? Yeah. Many ways to skin a cat. I'd say yes, but there's only a few really good ways.
Yes. Yep.
Right. In other words, there's a way I can, you know, I could travel from here to Jersey where you're at, right? Just go from state to state, go right across the U.S. And yeah, I can do that. That's one way to get there. But the other way is to go the direct opposite way by way of Hawaii. Do they both get me to New Jersey? Yeah. Are they both really efficient? No.
Yeah.
So when people say, oh, you know, whatever. No. It's not. That's not it.
Yeah.
It's there's a bunch of ways to produce power. But I'm going to tell you that throwing medicine balls isn't as effective as using a barbell with weight on it in a snatch or a clean or a pull variation. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, when people say, oh, there's a bunch of ways to do it. Yeah, there is. But not a whole bunch of really effective ways.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually funny. I was on the phone with Kyle Rogers the other day. And for those who don't know, Kyle works with Bob. And basically he made that. I couldn't remember exactly what the quote was, but he quoted that. And he actually might have even said it in the conversation that he got that from you. And it's funny. Just
better be citing me.
It's just funny. It's funny to hear you say it now, because like, we're literally just having a conversation one day, kind of just going back and forth about stuff, and he referenced that, and I loved it. And he was like, yeah, Bob said this to me the other day. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. He's a wise one, so that makes sense.
Old wise. I'll pick one of them.
Listen, we're two young guys learning still, so it's nice to you know, be able to talk to someone like you and kind of get that insight and everything. But So we kind of, and this is going to happen a lot, but we went on a little bit of a tangent. But high performance model wise, if I were to say to you, like, what you would think is the single biggest issue right now with the way a majority of programs, institutions are structured, you know, when it comes to their sports performance departments, you know, those that aren't using that model, what would you say that the issue is?
Well, at the college level, I think the biggest issue is not having good leadership in that area, which is going to be senior staff. And in our case, our leader, Mike Izzy, who's our athletic director, I mean, it didn't matter if I invented the damn barbell, right? If he's not in support of performance, then I am really only useful to the degree that he allows me to perform. In his case, it's mine, right? I speak on behalf of the athletic director, right? So that's number one. So that allows me to put into place, you know, my experience and expertise in running the model. And so that's the first thing you have to have. And then from there on in, it's just really getting everybody together to function as a unit. So again, let's back up a little bit. You have the athletic director in place. Professionally, it's got to be the GM and the president. The next step is not to have director of high performance. The next step is to have senior associate athletic director in charge of high performance. It's got to be somebody in the senior staff.
That's basically telling the athletic director, or not even telling, or like making recommendations or assisting them in making the right hire, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're senior staff. You're part of the cabinet. And in pro sports, it's got to be an assistant GM. It can't be, you know, head strength coach or head performer. It's got to come from the general manager. Otherwise, all you're doing is what we do for the most part anyways, just suggest. It becomes a suggestion. Hey, I want so-and-so to sit out, or I need 2 more weeks to work on this guy's hamstring. That's just a suggestion. In the high-performance model, when you have the right leadership, it's an edict. It's not a suggestion. This is what we're going to do. I'm not suggesting it to you. We're doing that. So that's the biggest problem, I think, of installing this thing. Because I think I said the other day on Twitter or something like, I mean, I hope everybody who thinks this position is a good spot doesn't have to wait till they're 62 years old like me. I believe there's tons of guys right now that can do it. But I think you do need to have a certain amount of experience.
I'll say experience is huge, yeah.
Yeah, it's got to – well, so you have to be – you have to have the experience and the expertise. Sometimes the two don't go together, right? Hopefully this spot will. But, you know, from coast to coast, the overwhelming majority, the staggering majority of supervisors at the collegiate level who have oversight over the performance units really have no idea what we do. They couldn't properly evaluate us because they don't have – the subject matter expertise. They're not even competent in the area, right? So this lately, this David LaPlaca came out. I think you may have seen it on Twitter. This 46 characteristics.
Yes, I actually have. I have that in my notes. We'll get to that. Yeah, but hey, if it's early, let's do it.
Which I participated in. Competent and expert coaches. So there's even a difference between competent and expert coaches, right? Well, I don't think you know. You can't have somebody, and this is another thing that I see that's disturbing, right? You have somebody evaluating you, putting it on a institutional document, how your performance is. How could they possibly do that? They wouldn't know if we're doing the right thing. One, they're not around enough.
Yeah.
And two, even if they were, they kind of generally get the idea of it, but they wouldn't be able to see the nuances that somebody in the profession like you and others would say, yeah, that's not, we shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah. It's like me judging a chef and I've never cooked before. Like why would, that would make no sense. Like why would, where would I know how to do that?
Yeah. Right. So that's one of those things that, that reminds me of, there was a group back in the '80s called Third Base and they were doing a thing on Vanilla Ice. It was a rap on Vanilla Ice. And one of the things in there was, I've never heard of a chef that can't cook, right? Cause the guy wasn't for real. But that's the same thing. Like, how can you evaluate that? So that's, I mean, that's bothersome when you have somebody evaluating you that, and it becomes an institutional document. I mean, that's a pretty serious thing, right?
Yeah.
And we're covering the entire athletic department. No other place covers all students out of the unit like that, right? So maybe academics, maybe you have an academics, which isn't connected to athletics, but they cover all the students. No, they have a bunch of people in there covering all the students. They don't have any one unit, right? With athletic trainers where you have this piece where we see them and they don't see them every day. By the end of the week, and sometimes by Tuesday, Monday, Tuesday, we've seen every athlete in the department. Well, a spot that's very highly ranked within the cabinet. I mean, it is athletics, right? And it is students in that. They're not there because we're coaching. We're coaching because they're there.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing. You want to have a direct line to the athletic director, a direct line to the GM, which I had with Billy Bean. That was a whole different story, but you got to have that sort of walk-in capability to talk about serious topics about your student athlete. So anyway, I kind of got off track. So it's got to be athletic director. It's got to be senior associate athletic director, which is my title, which I believe too is Eric Corum's. And I think it's Pat Ivey's too.
I was going to bring up William & Mary. It's funny. Yeah. I was going to actually bring Kurt talked a lot about William & Mary when I had him on talking about this.
Yeah, and I don't know what extent their responsibilities reach out to in their reporting lines, but still, as a senior associate athletic director, I mean, in the normal structure, there's not anybody higher than that except the athletic director. But that's the model you have to have so that things can get put in place. They don't get ignored. And if they get ignored, it's against policy and it gets addressed.
Yeah. You made a great point too. Like, it's not a recommendation. It's an edict. Like, this is what we're doing, not this is what we want to do. Or like, it has to be that way in the sense that like the people who know what those decisions are going to be have the final say to say, no, like, this is what's going to happen. Like, it's not a recommendation or I'm not asking you. It's like, no, like, I'm the expert here. Like, this is what I'm telling you is going to happen. And you also mentioned the idea of, you know, having a job evaluation come from someone who isn't, you know, well-versed in the field, or they might even know like a little bit about it, but not nearly enough to make that type of evaluation. And you also have made points before about the idea of being hired by someone, you know, who isn't well-versed in the realm of strength conditioning or training or sports performance. It's like, it's a very dicey situation for that to be occurring.
It's a horrible situation.
Yeah.
Right? It's a horrible situation. So let me just say the underpinning of this thing is in the sports performance unit, which the coach is a part of. I mean, a sport coach has to be a part of that. We are going to defer to the subject matter expertise, you know, and then be in full agreement that that's where this particular discussion is coming from. If it's athletic training, if it's an issue about return to play, time off from injury, in that area, we can all discuss it. But in the end, we'll all look at the athletic trainer and say, okay, what are we going to do? You've heard the group. That's really the piece right there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you mentioned too, like, the sport coach needs to be involved. In your opinion, to what degree though? Like, what, so when I had Kurt on, we talked a lot about how, the pitfalls of, you know, the sports performance staff changing when the coaches change. So like, let's look at a high level Division I, like Power Five football program. If the coach leaves, then odds are that the new coach is bringing in their own staff, their own strength coach, et cetera. But how in the high performance model, that is staying intact. Like, that's not changing unless changes are made by, you know, whoever's in the, you know, control of the, you know, sports performance department. So like, he mentioned William and Mary as an example, how, you know, there were ATCs that were there. And when, you know, this system was switched over, you know, some of the ATCs were let go because they refused to work with the strength coaches. Or, you know, they just basically didn't like the idea that they had to like confer or talk to what they, in their mind, had a very warped kind of perception on what a strength coach was. And, they looked at it as like, oh, like, they don't know what they're doing. Why am I going to listen to that? You know, that guy, like, that makes no sense to me. So they were let go because he had to find people that were going to come in and be willing to kind of collaborate and work together. Anyway, you know, the point Kurt made was that I thought this was great was like, if you create this environment in this high performance model, you're creating a situation where the sports performance staff is intact and maintained and there's continuity there versus like so much turnover that might happen if coaches are let go. Like, why should a sport coach leaving or coming in dictate what the performance staff is doing?
Well, I'm in total agreement there. That's why we have to be very careful of how we align ourselves too, and how we speak, how we have our conversations about the unit itself. Because, you know, when you start talking about, hey, you know, I've been really good. I've been with this football team and, you know, we've been 11-0. Like, whoa, now. You start attaching yourself to a record, then that makes it really easier to get you fired. And by the way, I don't think we have some influence over winning and losing, right? I mean, you know, healthy, strong, fast, and all that. But in the end, we don't call plays. We don't substitute. Yeah. We don't decide who we recruit. I mean, so, you know, are you telling me that, hey, you're not doing a good job with the running backs because he had 12 carries for 22 yards. I say you should have called better plays then.
Yeah.
Because this guy's gotten vertical jump is X, his sprint is this.
Yeah, like, all my metrics are good. What do you mean it's my fault?
Yeah, he got 22 yards. We're at. So, yeah, it is sad that that happens. But let me tell you how this works. And I think in the end, when somebody comes in and says, hey, I'm bringing my guy, we say, well, we want you to, which is why we also have a full vetting coming from several other members of the department. right? So yeah, give us your recommendation, and then we'll also interview him, right? Because look, we want him to be you, but there's a good chance that you may not see pieces that we are going to see. And people will say, well, you know, you can't really do that. And I say, that's a bunch of BS. Of course you can. You know why? Because you're protecting the university, you're protecting the athletic department, and head coach, we're protecting you, right? So that's why we want to make sure that, yeah, we hope to hell this is the guy. But we want to be able to come back to you and say, hey, we saw a couple things here. Are you aware of this? And once that happens, you may know stuff that you shouldn't know. And that changes the whole process. So I agree with Kurt. If we have somebody in place that's a fantastic coach, so on and so forth, then they should stay. When, you know, so really, to me, it seems like when you say, I got my guy, okay, sounds to me like, you know, somewhere in there, there's this confusion about loyalty and following everything I tell you to do, right? That doesn't sound like loyalty to me. It doesn't sound like something I'd want to be a part of, right? And if you're saying, well, he's done a great job with my guys, we say, okay, well, we're coming to a place where there's different guys. So we need to look at, you know, a little better at how this thing is going to unfold. I think it can happen. And, you know, not to be, what can I say? Not to be too scorched earth on this thing. But I'm going to suggest to you that should the hiring practices and the supervision and oversight of positions in the unit, it's not just strength coaches. Trust me when I tell you, when kids have died, it has not been just strength coaches. That we're, if there was a little bit better vetting, if everybody had more to go on than this is my guy, things wouldn't be the way they were.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, like, I don't even like want to mention specifics of like the cases where kids have passed away. It's just kind of sad to even talk about. But you are right in the sense that, like, it definitely wasn't all the strength coach. What is the strength coach being pushed to do? Like, there's a lot of influence on that by everybody. Like, it's not like maybe the strength coach didn't want to run the conditioning the way it was being run, but he was being told it had to be, the effect had to be a certain way. Like, how could we know? And whatever, there has to be parameters to make that judgment. And I think that that's another really good point.
There's certainly doesn't dismiss the culpability of whoever was
of course, yeah,
in charge of the session. Right. But there's a lot of players involved with that. You know, and how this thing goes. I mean, look, something, when somebody hears of some sort of aberrant sort of strength and conditioning practice out there, it's my contention that, you know, the coach just didn't bump their head and start doing that, right? That happens. That's been happening, right? And there is a lot of mechanisms behind all this that all of us understand. At the same time, where's the oversight of that? Where's the person that should be watching that and saying, hey, Layla, come, hey, listen, we can't do that anymore. I'm trying to save you and us. Don't do that anymore. You know, that's what comes from good supervision. So I think switch over and staffs, I mean, no, it's becoming more prevalent now. It's starting to move from basketball and football into baseball, into some other arenas. We need to do a better job of vetting. And again, with you got the right model in place and, you know, hiring and all that's not, it's not a perfect system, but you got to be able to put yourself in a spot where you say, we feel strongly that this is the right way to go in whatever way you do go, so that the likelihood of things happening are going to be good.
Yeah. I think the other thing too, and I mentioned this briefly, and I could tell there was kind of like the disdain from you, like when I was saying it, from the ATCs at William and Mary that didn't want to listen to, the strength coaches, and how they did the due diligence to bring an entire new staff in of people that wanted to actually you know, work together with the strength coaches. And it kind of relates a little bit to the fact that, like, I talked to, Mike Boyle about this, on my, this past week's episode about, kind of the picture that's painted of strength coaches in the industry sometimes. And basically he was saying how important it is to emphasize, how we carry ourselves because, you know, we have to do ourselves favors. We're not doing ourselves any favors in the way we're looked at by others in the field, whether it's sport coaches, ATCs, whatever. If we're not acting appropriately and accordingly and, you know, having to kind of make ourselves be taken a little more seriously. But right. How much strength coaches can sometimes be undermined when there's not that collaborative, linked together effort, whether it's like a sport coach making changes or determinations for conditioning or programming when they shouldn't be, or, you know, the ATC is not respecting the strength coach. Like it's important for that not to happen.
Well, I mean, you're talking about two things there. You know, Mike and I agree on almost every single thing together, with small, small differences, but he's right. I mean, you have to hold yourself in a certain way, but look, I don't want to make this an ATC strength conditioning coach thing. Number one, it's like, it's been a problem in the past. It's like the worst kept secret in athletics, you know, the battle that the athletic trainers and strength conditioning coaches have. But I'll say this, anybody in the unit, the performance unit, who doesn't want to work with somebody else should be fired, period.
Yeah, yeah.
Not ATC, it's not strength, anybody. And when you have that in place, you know, a collaborative effort doesn't mean that you can't, as a trainer, talk about nutrition. Of course you can. That's what this is for. I mean, when you look at the science behind collaborative groups, if you look at business models, the groups that talk the most amongst each other are the most prolific and they get the most done. You can't just sit there and see something that you don't think is right and let it happen. That's what the unit's for.
Well, I like to say, I tweeted this before. It's like not about you can move lanes. You don't have to stay in your lane, but you know, throw your turn signal on and do it the right way. Like don't like undermine people and whatever. Right. It's like, there's a way to go about it. Right.
Right. And so that, and I think all of us have a thing, but when you start, you know, as a strength coach, if you start giving nutrition advice, when you have a sports nutritionist on board, I'm coming in right away and saying, you need to shut your mouth.
Yeah.
That's not what you're involved in. If somebody comes to you in the weight room and says, hey, you know, I need to put on a little more muscle or I need to drop some weight, what do you think? I say, I think you need to go talk to the sports nutritionist.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what you do. You don't, yes. There's no reason to comment on that. So, I wouldn't lock this whole, headbutting thing into athletic trainers and strength coaches. Again, I think that problem has occurred because one thinks that they're the other.
Mm, yeah.
So when you finally say, no, you're not, you know, then you can be okay talking about topics. Cause in the end, you know, whoever's got the subject matter expertise is going to have the final say in that area. Carrying yourself professionally is a whole different thing, right? I mean, that we could talk about that forever. We've seen it all on Twitter and all that. I just say to all those saying, what do you think about so-and-so? What do you think about so-and-so? I say, look, if you think what so-and-so is doing is the wrong thing, your best fight against that is for you to do the right thing. You don't need to sit there and blast that guy or that woman for doing that. You do what's right, and hopefully that's going to prevail at some point.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's almost like, you know, if you see something out there that you don't think is the right way to go about doing things, but you keep doing it the way that you think is right, and eventually there'll be a shift in, you know, how others are seeing it, and maybe there'll be a change made just from that alone.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. You mentioned before the list of the validated characteristics differentiating expert and competent strength and conditioning coaches. So just correct me if I'm wrong, you're basically saying like the difference between like someone who you would say is like, all right, like they do a good job versus someone that you say, okay, like they're an expert, like they're top of their field type of thing. Like what are those qualities basically?
Well, I think it's better to look at the paper. And I've read it a couple of times and I'm kind of focusing on certain areas of it, but not digesting the entire thing yet. But what came to light was, the difference between competent and expert. which we haven't really talked about. You know, we talk about experts, but we never talk about competence. So, you know, David did a great job of getting the categories in shape. I know what was on there was primarily summarized as those coaches were typically coaches that had master's degrees, typically had more than one certification, and had more than 10 years of experience was the whole poll, right? And that poll was all the way through every aspect and level of sport, a little bit of everything. So we had a good cross section, and there was enough coaches to come to a hypothesis. I wouldn't say a conclusion, but I think it's better to read the whole thing before you can say, you know, here's where we're at. I mean, you know, empathy was involved in there. The athlete first, you know, compassion, communication, a lot of good topics that we talk about. And somebody else came online because I posted that when David sent me, I think as a participant, you got a copy of the study. And I put it out right away because this is the first time that we have an official document that says what we do and what makes us different. This has been our problem all along, right? That GMs, presidents, athletic directors, they really don't know what makes, you know, a guy with 5 years of experience different than a woman with 20, right? There's a difference. And so now we've got these characteristics that say, this is what we do, this is how we do it, this is where our value is. And when you put that out there, it also says, this is who you're not, a person who thinks they're doing training, right? And so that's the first time that we have something where you can have a discussion with a paper in hand and say, look, here's a research paper that says, generalizing for sure, but says, you know, what expert is, what's competent, and where they belong. And that should go a long way in several aspects of our profession. So I think anybody who can read it should read it and put it on social media and get it out and keep pumping it out.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to share that too when I post a show, but what would you say if you had to, but I know this is a tough question because there were so many, but like, what are some of the bigger ones for you on that list? Like that you think are, you know, they're all important, but like ones that caught your eye the most or that you think are maybe the should be prioritized the most?
I think the one that I like most is that you're always learning, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, look, if I say this and I don't know this to be true, but I'm going to guess that somebody my age, number one, is probably done doing this for the most part. But there's also a lot of coaches I think that are my age that kind of brush off the idea of technology, right?
Yeah.
And they just say, oh, I don't need that. You know, that doesn't do me any good and all that. Well, you know, if I've been smart at all, I've been smart enough to know that that's not true. So, you know, I'm trying to look at everything I can to make sure that I'm up to date with everything. And I think that's been a quality that's really been helpful for me, to be able to keep up with the whole idea of this thing. So, that's the one I think is always learning. Humility is in there a little bit, wanting to bring others along to continually teach and uplift the profession has been another one. But besides that, I just, you know, I think it's just really delineating. I mean, so there's 46 that they came out with. You know, the degree of validity was set by David. And so, you know, the top couple were what came out to be the most. Following that was several other ones. But I think you can't just look at any one of those things because they are inclusive to lead you to believe what the difference is between one coach and another. And, you know, of course, the value of balancing experience and expertise was in there. I mean, that's an important thing. That's not to say that somebody with 15 years of experience doesn't have more expertise than somebody with 30. And I think that's important to know, too.
Yeah, I like what is it going on in those years? Like, did a person have 5 years of experience where they were literally doing, you know, training hundreds of athletes, like, you know, in the trenches, whatever it is, like they have a lot of, you know, they have a lot of results to speak of or things like that? Or was it like 20 years that was different than that? It does make a difference for sure.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
And I think that's like a big thing too, is that getting away from that idea of saying like, oh, just because someone's in the field for 20 years doesn't mean that, one, that they alone are an expert in the field, and two, that they're more of an expert than someone with only, you know, 5 years in the field. Like the time served in, but what goes into that time is a huge indicator of, you know, if that experience is valid enough to make that judgment, right?
Well, I would agree.
Yeah. So you mentioned something on the list about, you know, uplifting the field. And, I've seen a lot of back and forth on this on social media, like, you know, uplifting, maybe if something you see that you don't like, and you mentioned this before about, you know, if you can carry yourself the right way, it'll maybe outdo or eventually just like kind of keep working towards getting rid of the things that you see that, you know, aren't the right way to do things. But is there a time and place to, you know, make sure that people know, you know, so like we're going to talk about the core, a little bit. If you saw someone on Twitter, let's just say, you know, putting videos out saying like, oh, like we do crunches, this is, you need to do crunches, a lot of crunches are like the reason, for success with the core and everything. Like, yeah, I understand that. Like if a coach means well, there's a really good way to go about it with etiquette, maybe reach out to them separately, et cetera. But in certain times where there's just like such a flippant and, you know, lack of care, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it at this current time, like for what is right and what should be done the right way. Like you have to not turn a blind eye to things sometimes, right?
Well,
it depends who you are, but
that's my strength and my weakness, right? There's some things that you just can't unsee.
That's what I mean, right? Like, like if you see someone doing crunches over and over again, and they're literally writing captions like, this is the way you need to train your core, there's no other way, like ignore the other stuff you hear, like it's got to be done this way, well, that's kind of damaging.
Well, I've always said that if you're going to put something on Twitter, you know, make sure that you take care in what you write, because somebody may believe you. So that's really important. So when you say this is the top three quadricep exercises, well, we can look that up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's the way you work things. You know, yeah.
Force. We can look at EMG. We can look at many, many things, biomechanics. We can actually determine whether or not that's the case. So that's the kind of stuff that I look at and say, I'm going to look at that. So it could be like, oh shit, that's good. That guy's right. That girl's right. But yeah, so that's the kind of stuff I can't say, but I will tell you this, that as David divided this thing up into, like, for instance, he divided it up into knowledge areas, right? And the number one, I don't know, the number one score in the knowledge area was, in fact, I'm looking at it right now. An expert S&C coach has a strong knowledge of training and technique of movements, which enables the coach to apply simple and effective coaching cues to their athletes. Right. So that doesn't have to be this most unbelievable Star Wars-y sort of exercise. The basics still work. They've worked forever and they will continue to work forever. So when you start trying to find somebody there that's saying, wow, this is it, you know, one leg, one arm, stand on a ball, you know, Cirque du Soleil, this and that and the other thing, we know that's not true. We can look at that. So I think it's our responsibility to speak to that. I mean, for us not to say something means that we are in agreement.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, and now granted, there's only so much time in the day to look at some of that stuff. So, but you know, we all know what to take and what not to take. I mean, it's hard to really watch a crunch and say, you know, let's spend an hour trying to talk somebody down off of a crunch. I mean, look, there's very few exercises that don't do nothing. Right. Everything does something. It's the same thing we talked about earlier, right? 1,000 ways to skin a cat. Everything does something. But is that the best way to do it? Is that the best way in your gym to do it? You have the right facility, you know, like, yeah, power cleans are fantastic. If you don't have bumper plates, you better have plan B. Yeah. Right. So
Or if you don't, if you're not good at teaching them, or you never were well versed in doing them, and you struggle, then all right, like there's probably a couple other good ways to go about it. But what are they, and why do you do them, and how do you implement them?
Right, right. So that's, I mean, I think that the knowledge in your area is the piece that says, okay, what exercise fits this today with her, this month, this sport. That's the piece where the expertise comes in, and now the art of what we do becomes a little more important.
Yeah. I mentioned the crunches just because it was an easy example for me. I'm sitting here looking at this outline, and we're going to talk a little bit about the core and core stability. But I talked to Mike about this a little bit on his episode, and he was like, yeah, for years, like, you know, for 30 years ago, that was what we did. Like, we did abs. Like, that was what you did. After the end of the session, you did some bicycles and some crunches, and that was your core work. And then, you know, things came out that showed us, you know, maybe some of the negatives and the drawbacks of flexing and extending the spine, and, you know, a different way to look at, you know, why are we training the core? And is it, like you said, in the tweet you put out, the core is more than just the abdominals, not even about them fully. Like there's so I'll read the definition officially in a second, but that you posted, but like what in your mind, like what did you have the same experience as Mike in the sense where like in the past, you know, however many years of your career, like things have changed in the sense of like how we are training the core and core stability, and were you doing it a different way at one time?
Let's see. So that's a couple of questions.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay. No. But it, the way you said it made me think about it. So are we training the core differently now? I would say no.
Okay.
Because if you're doing the core right, we're still doing RDLs. We're still doing deadlifts. We're still squatting. That's core work, right? Because the guy has your glutes and erectors involved in that.
Yep.
And there's a little bit of stability training. I still feel that the high bar back squat is one of the most dynamic core stabilizers you can possibly
do. For the extensors, right? Like it's
for it all.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't tilt that. You can't put a heavy load on there and tilt 1 degree right and handle it.
Yeah.
Because you're so stiff, right? So it's the best anti-rotation, anti-flexion, anti-extension exercise you can probably do. But what I say is, you know, one of the few phrases I've ever coined in my almost 40 years of coaching is, you know, tell me what you're doing and I'll tell you what we used to call it.
Jim Malone mentioned that when he was on. He's like, yeah, Bobby's favorite quote is, show me what you're calling it now, and I'll tell you what we used to call it.
Yeah. So years ago, what we used to call right there at the hip used to be called the power zone.
Okay.
So it would start right at the middle of the hip, and then you draw a circle. And as you drew the circle outwardly, that area became less important to the power producing area.
Okay.
Right. So when you look at the glutes and the quads and the abs and the erectors, you know, that's a very powerful, that's where everything comes from. And so, now we've called it the core, but for by and large, when you see somebody doing core training, it's usually the abdominal area they're speaking of. And so when you talk about, oh, we need a more strong core and all that, there's nothing out there that says that, you know, well, you take core training, or at least in trained athletes, where you take a core training, which is planks and all that, which, by the way, if you do them enough, they just become a warm-up. There's no more strengthening anymore. So that's going to make you run faster and jump higher. It's going to be the combination of stuff, right? In that whole thing we talked about, it's hip, hamstrings, those are very, very important to injury reduction. Very important. So you can't just limit yourself to those plank exercises, and you can't just limit them into one plane. It has to be rotation. It has to be flexion. It has to be extension, both in both frontal planes and lateral and diagonal and all these other ways. So it's got to be more than that. If you think you're going to spend your time on your abdominal structure and get rid of your back pain while ignoring your back, which I think that's why backs stay hurt, is because people stay away from training the back. you're wishing something that's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that about the back thing. Like, you do need to. So I with baseball players, right? Like, they do constant rotation asymmetrically. Like, I see it all the time when, like, a guy goes to the PTs that I work with and they have that lower back issue and they're crunching down on the facet joints and they things lock up. It's like, yeah, we need to do some work with the quote unquote, you know, anterior core to like kind of make sure that subsides a little bit, but they do a lot of work on that particular area. Like there's, and if they didn't, it wouldn't heal up or recover the way that it does.
Well, I mean, again, there's so much common sense involved in this stuff. I mean, when I came back to the A's my second time, mm-hmm. I, you know, had the epiphany. I just heard it differently. When somebody says, all we do is twist and twist and twist. So what, you know, when you design programs, you design them on need. So if somebody who's twisting and twisting and twisting, what do they need? They need to stop twisting and twisting and twisting. And they need to do something that's opposite of that, which is anti-rotation. So I immediately just went into that mode, anti-rotation, because they're doing enough rotation. In fact, when I
was so glad you said that one day, I got ridiculed for saying that once about how, like, in season, they're doing a lot of rotating. So they're doing thousands of reps of swinging and throwing. Like, why are we going to keep working that while they're training versus like giving them some of what they're not getting? Sort of like how you wouldn't have a hockey player do all this like lateral work in season while they're literally skating all day. Craig Edwards says that a lot about like how he trains his hockey players. But anyway, I was thrilled when you came out and said that, because it kind of confirmed for me that I was like on the right track with that. Why would you give someone something they're getting a lot of while they're practicing six times a week?
Right. It's like, and again, we only know what we know, right? When I got to UCLA in 1984, my first team was crew. And at that time, the notion was, well, let's see, you know, they got to go 2000 meters. They're going to get about 200 strokes in. So we have to wrap ourselves around 200 reps somehow, you know, get, you know, four sets of 50 or, you know, because we thought that's what you do. Well, in fact, that's not what you do, because now you're doing pattern overload, right? It's got to be, what don't they get? Well, they get plenty of endurance training. So we got to go the other direction, give them high intensity, lower volume loads, heavy, heavy loads. Same with distance runners. You know, you don't need to do reps with them. What they lack is strength. So in baseball, they're doing tons of twisting. We can do some off-season twisting, because it's hard to get that amount of batting practice and twisting going on. And by the way, if you're a right-handed hitter, not only do you not need to twist, you definitely don't need to twist to the left when you're swinging. You need to go the other way to balance yourself out. So I thought, I immediately changed everything I did right then and there. And I was going to say, when I was going through the Moneyball period my first time with the A's, we didn't do one crunch, one twist, one leg raise, nothing. But we did squat heavy with our pitchers. We didn't have one rotational sort of injury, one back or abdominal or oblique or nothing. So that sold me on heavy squatting for pitchers in that area. And they were all throwing over 90. So that was something that was just kind of anecdotal, but it did happen.
Yeah.
So I thought to myself, okay, well, that makes sense.
Yeah. It's funny. I never really, the way you describe the high bar back squat, and, you know, obviously like anyone who's squatted before knows that if you take one little, especially with the high bar, if you go one little bit to the right or left, like you're done, like you're not going to be able to do it. And how it comprises like all those elements that we're talking about. And like anything, like if you're programming in a way that's built around movement patterns and some of like the core principles of what we do, it's like you're not going to need to spend a half hour training the quote unquote core afterwards. Like, yes, you can do some, you know, any time my guys do lowers, like they'll, you know, hit their Palloff press or a Swiss ball extension or there's something, but like, they're not going to spend 45 minutes doing it. Like there's not a core day. Like, oh, we're doing core today. Like, no.
Plus it's reps after reps, right? If you're looking for strength, well, we know that strength happens at 85% and above, right? So when you're doing sets of 20 on an abdominal exercise,
it's amazing you say that. Like, I'll give you an example, and I'm see what you think about this. Like, if I was doing a 3-day training week, right? And let's just say it was for the average athlete. Like, I felt like they could still benefit from getting their speed work, and it's very conjugate style. Like, they can get their dynamic work on day one, their strength work more so on day two, and maybe some rep stuff on day three. We'll go full body with all of them and like, kind of let them still work all those attributes in conjunction with each other. And then as they develop, I'll tailor them to, you know, one way or more or the other based on, you know, what I see that they need. But why people don't think of training the core the same way you would train any other thing, like, on our dynamic day, maybe they're doing their core work is a throw or a slam or something like that. On the heavy day, it's maybe a heavy farmer's walk. And then maybe they are doing a 15 rep ab rollout or a 45 second pal off press hold. Like, you can work train the core the same way you would train any other. And you make a great point about that. Like, if we're doing 20 reps all the time, where are we building any strength? Like, it's not, there's no load that's heavy enough on it.
I would agree with you. Yeah, that seems pretty simple, right? Again, one of those common sense things.
Yeah, like you mentioned the pitfalls of like, all right, let's go do 20 leg lifts. Well, what did we do that you know, really exposed us to any kind of loading that is really conducive to building strength? We didn't.
Right. Agreed.
So from what you're saying now, let's just say you went from the in-season to the off-season now. You brought the rotational work back in and things that they maybe were doing. I mean, you have to remember too, like, not as much volume, but they are still rotating in the off season because they're practicing and they're trying to, you know, hone their craft. They're throwing bullpens when they're pitchers or taking swings, right, but maybe not as extreme as it is during the in season.
Right. Right. So you want me to talk about that program?
I'm saying, like, were you moving more, like, what was the process like for you kind of introing some of the rotational power stuff back in once the off season came around?
Oh, just slow twist. I mean, you have to kind of be, you know, easy with it. I think abdominal, you know, twisting crunches, twisting bicycles, stuff where you're just active, you know, back and forth just to keep that moving. They're going to be swinging and throwing a little bit. But again, you know, listen, pro baseball is a little bit different than college or high school. So, you know, we're swinging, throwing, warming up every single day from mid-February till hopefully the middle of October, or maybe a little bit later. Yeah. So You know, that's a 4 week off. We're starting back with like two sets of, you know, 10 to 20. I mean, it's not, they have to start on their own. There's really nothing quite like swinging a bat or throwing a ball. All you can try to do is try to at least keep some sort of, you know, rotational pattern going. I wouldn't rest anything on it saying like, wow, you know, our guys really hit a lot of homers this year. I think it was because of my med ball routine. Like, come on, come on now. You
know, like, well, yeah, it's just the same thing as like, oh, my running back ran for 180 yards last week. Doesn't mean you were any more successful in that. Just like, it shouldn't be the blame on you when you run for 20. It's like, if you want to have your cake, you want to have your cake and eat it too. Like, one of my older hockey teams is like 38-3 right now. If they lose a couple games, if I'm taking credit for that and then they lose a couple games, well, then I should take the fault for it. It's like, it doesn't work that way. I just need to know that the metrics that we're working on or the health part of things are going the right way in what I do. And that's all I can control. So it's ridiculous. Yeah, it's ridiculous to take credit for it either way.
I think you just got to stay away from it. Guys are jumping higher, running faster. The more flexible I get, better footprints on the force plate, our 3D motion capture, that's it. Whatever happens after that is something else. I mean, that's what you've got to lay on. You've got to lay on your percent increases in athletic development patterns and just stay away from the other stuff. Yeah. You know, and just say, I mean, years and years ago, I started purposely trying to say, hey, you know, when somebody talks about your, you know, like my baseball training program, I just say, well, you know, I was associated with some pretty good teams then. That's the most you can say. Look, we're strength and conditioning coaches. Now I'm an administrator, but still active. We're not any more or less than that, right? So when you start saying, you know, again, this thing gets really wide too, because then you're also saying that teams that have bad records don't have good strength coaches. Well, that's not true either.
Yeah.
You know, so I think as a profession, we have to get with that a little bit. You know, I mean, there's a lot of great coaches out there, Division III, Division II. You know, it's like talking about the Premier League. Like, you know, oh, at one point, Manchester United was wiping everybody out. And they're saying, oh, their strength and conditioning program must be so good. And I say, do you mean to tell me that you think that the last place team isn't any good? You know, strength and conditioning wise, that every Every player in that league is in the top physical condition, right? One, Man United had the money then and was buying the good players. And two, that's just where it is. You know, there's a difference between skill level and fitness.
Yes.
So, you know, and you look at the Premier League like, oh, so you're telling me they're in the Premier League, but they're just not in as good a shape as the teams above them. Like, that's absurd.
Yeah, well, it's like if one of my good hockey players, like, has a sick toe drag, like, drags the puck in, like, around the goalie. Like, what the hell did I do to make him good at that? I did nothing.
Just stay away from it.
Yeah.
It doesn't make you anything less. I mean, everybody knows what you're doing.
It's insecurity, I think, in the sense that, like you said, everyone knows what you're doing. If you know what you do is the right stuff and you are doing the right stuff, usually the players will be the first to say, like, hey, this guy had a big hand in what I've done. Like,
right.
That's
and the data is going to tell you. And, you know, we are a part of the injury mechanism too. So, you know, your one loss record is on that a little bit. And you know, we're never going to prevent an injury, right? So I'm getting ready to do this ACL presentation to my athletic training staff because it's been a topic of concern as it is for everybody. And I want to see if I can find this slide here as we speak. It's about injury prevention, and it was actually in a study, right? It was in a study that Webster and Hewitt did in 2018 regarding the term prevention in literature. I live and die by this, right? And this is a paper. This is out of a research paper. It implies stopping a specific event from occurring, and that's not likely what these programs do. Prevention is the action of stopping something from happening or arising. Alternatively, reduction is the action or fact of making a specified thing smaller or less in amount, degree, or size. The outcome these studies measure and report that result from a prevention program is the amount of risk reduction or change in ACL injury incident rates post-intervention, not prevention. By definition, we can prevent an ACL injury. I'm sorry. By definition, if we can prevent an ACL injury, then we can predict an ACL injury.
Yes.
And so that's why I stay away from that term prevention. It's ridiculous. And again, anybody who also says the word predict and anything they're present to you is full of crap.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's like that's just – you hit the nail on the head. If I can say I can prevent something, then I can predict it because that's the kind of the crux of like the entire thing. But that's ACL injuries. It's like you can't predict, you know, the load at the certain time, at the angle, whatever. There's so many variables to it. So to say you can prevent it means that you can predict all those variables. And that's just a very slippery slope to go down because we know you cannot possibly do that.
Smart about it, you know?
Yeah. Like anything, like how many times you've said that this podcast on any different topics, just be smart about something. Like it's easy, common sense. Like, you know, things get kind of overdone or underdone in certain ways, and it just makes them, you know, more complicated than they have to be. So not to get off the topic of the core too much, because I wanted to read this definition, but so basically the tweet you had, Bering Sorensen definition, core stability identified as quote unquote, the abdominal back extensor and hip musculature strength / function that contribute to stability of the lumbopelvic hip region complex where a person's center of gravity is located and all movement begins. And this is from 1984.
Yep.
Crazy how like things are still being done that aren't really working towards that definition, right?
Well, that's strength and conditioning, right? We love to rename stuff, you know, redefine it when there's no other profession that does that. So when you talk about what Mike talked about, holding ourselves accountable, professional, I mean, this is, you know, what happens way too often. We change the way things are. I mean, this was stated in 1984 out of the Ireland study in 2002. But that's exactly what we used to do years ago. It was called the power zone at the time. And that's what core stability is. So again, let's just take ACL, for instance. We talk about doing the clamshell. We talk about doing change of direction and all that, and you're doing all those things. Okay, if you're not also overloading the back extensors and the abdominal region, all that balance stuff isn't going to help you. So again, like you said, injury is comprised of many variables. I mean, unless somebody comes up and steps on your legs and breaks it, it's pretty hard to tell how something happens. You can come to some conclusion, you can come to an hypothesis. But when we talk about core stability, I mean, one of the things that's not talked about, it's talked about in the literature, but that's not talked about in physical therapy enough and athletic training enough and not enough in strength and conditioning, is the ability to handle the core. So you can have, let's say, you know, you're doing leg presses only and you do very little axial loading or exercise that really stress you in a standing position. Okay, so now you got these strong legs, strong hips. But when you plant, you can't control your upper body from leaning to one side or another. You're going to blow. So that's why this thing, this core stability thing, is all these things together. The other thing about the ACL thing and injury in general is that it's multifaceted. In other words, it's the timing and the synchronization of all those muscles firing at once that keeps you right. It's not any one of those things.
Yeah.
So to lay down and do exercises for your hip, or to sit in a leg extension, leg curl machine, and then put that all together and expect things to be good, is that better than doing nothing? Of course. Is it better than doing standing squats and plyometrics? No. We know that through the literature.
Yeah.
So again, it's this thing, you got to be able to figure this thing out, which is why the science is so important, which is what I also say, you know, the guys that are out there throwing that BS around about, oh, you know, we got this done in the weight room. Science doesn't help us out. It only tells us what we know. That's a bunch of crap, too, because there's a ton of stuff out there that can lead you, right? Not every study can study every single damn thing, but you can come up with some pretty good hypotheses if you understand exercise science and biomechanics.
Well, you can also see a study and you can kind of say, hey, that kind of sounds good to me. Let me go try it out, right? Like you said, it leads you to stuff. Like a study you might like kind of get a glimpse at and say, okay, like that sounds reasonable. Like I'm going to try some of those things. Like, for example, a study that I use a lot about, you know, resisted sprinting and the loads that are ideal for, you know, those type of things. Like I can read that and say, okay, those sound pretty reasonable and I could try those loads. And then I see that the benefits that my athletes are getting from it. And well, there you go. I just kind of stumbled upon a new way that I want to do my speed training. Like it can lead you to things, but like you said, you have to have that base of, you know, knowledge of the exercise science to really be good at applying it or kind of reasoning on what is useful and what may be like a load of crap, quite frankly.
And here's the thing that I also have found. And when I've written the articles for Simply Faster and in this study coming up, is take a good look at the references at the back. I mean, the citations back there can take you on a really good journey to look at some really cool things. So don't just read the study and don't just highlight it and they pop out at you and then, you know, just read the highlights. Read the whole study, but really look at the back when they reference certain statements. Look where that comes from, right? And see where that can also take you to another place and even add to a greater appreciation of the current study and what can be out there farther, right? So like when I look at Tim Hewitt, does a fantastic job with ACL return to play and post-surgical stuff and what he has put in as, you know, exercises to reduce risk, that, you know, you realize that cognition is part of an ACL injury risk. In other words, there was a study that was done on baseline concussion numbers. So before you go into a season, everybody does this test, right? So they have something to go into baseline going later. At the end of the year, they saw some ACL injuries. And this was a big study. His studies are pretty big. They had a thing that showed that the kids that had ACL injuries had lower cognitive scores, which means their decision making was a little bit slower. Well, that makes sense. I never would have found that out had I just read that one study that was referenced in the study. So I went to it and I thought, well, damn, okay, well that makes sense.
Yeah. For sure. That it's more than just looking at the conclusion that was drawn from the study or the abstract, like you said, like, and who really does that? I don't know anybody that would really go back and look at the references or the other things in there. And there's so much you can kind of get out of those things that you might not really kind of see on the surface.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. I had some stuff listed for, the core area, but I think we kind of like hit it all in the beginning. And I think that to kind of wrap things up with a little bit of a different perspective on studies and research, I think was great because I did spend a majority of the episode this past week with Mike talking about, you know, what he, how he feels about it. And he, listen, a lot of the points he made were fantastic about some of the biases that sometimes present themselves when studies are being done to kind of prove, you know, a point versus going in there with like that null hypothesis type of outlook on, okay, let's just see what's right or what's wrong or whatever. But there's obviously, and he would agree with this because he said it, but like there is benefit to be had from a lot of these things if you look at them the right way and apply them the right way.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, I think these studies are important to look at. I mean, you know, if you look for confirmation, you got to have more confirmation than, oh, it really works for us. Like, what the hell is that? You know, this is the time where we can just about look at every possible aspect of training and come to a really good conclusion, right? So, you know, it really works for us. There's no reason for somebody to come up with that unless it really doesn't work for them, which means that you can't prove that. Prove it to me. Persuade me. Change my mind. I want my mind changed because it just makes me smarter and helps my athletes better. So that's the challenge I want to put out to anybody who wants a debate, a healthy debate anyway, is change my mind. You know, I'm not set on this. If you can prove to me there's something better, right? And so that's where these studies are pertinent. Look, the other part too, when people say, oh, you got these scientists in a lab coat, so they don't know anything about training. That's a bunch of BS too. That's a cop out. I know plenty of PhDs who have CSCSs and are coaching at the same time. They're right there doing, I mean, it's a good list too, right? Joey Antonio is one of them. Sean Arndt, Doug Kalman, you know, Tim Hewitt's doing great research out there with ACL stuff. So these guys do know what's happening in the gym. They do know what's happening in the field. They're just not, you know, excising muscle fibers in a closed door lab. They're looking at real life stuff. And so it makes it even more important to look at the data. We can't say that this is the era of big data and then not present data, because you can put your watch on somebody and come up with GPS information. So don't tell me that, you know, like, well, you know, I don't need to look at that stuff. Like, are you kidding me? So you don't want to take the extra step to help athletes. Okay, that's clear. You don't have to.
Yeah, for sure. So I like to generally leave my guests with a little bit of a kind of, you know, leave, what do you want to leave the listener with type of thing, kind of take the floor. And if there's anything you wanted to kind of summarize, like what we talked about or any parting thoughts you had or things you weren't able to talk about that you wanted to, if there's anything, I hate to put you on the spot, but.
No, there's not. Nothing different than what we talked about. I just want to come back to what I think is going to be creating way more job opportunities in the future for coaches like yourself. Instead of waiting till you're 62, hop in a good seat at 42, even at 52, start working towards becoming a senior associate athletic director, an assistant GM, the high performance model. There's no reason to have great coaches end their career as a coach and not be able to go farther. In other words, when I'm a strength and conditioning coach, I coach whatever, let's say we coach eight teams, right? Mm-hmm. As a high performance director, now we can affect every single team, every single athlete in your unit, not just the ones that you're with, right? Now you can coach coaches, you can lead the sports medicine group. Here's the other thing too: as much as we like to talk about, you know, our position on the sports performance ladder, right, where people are just kind of like, yeah, whatever, you know, athletic trainers get pushed around a little bit too now. So it's also good to be able to say, look, sport coach, want you involved, need your input. But your input's not going to be, we need to squat. Your input's going to be, I'd like to have my athletes with stronger quadriceps. Or, you know, we're going to power clean. No, I need more vertical power, more vertical force. Mm, we, yeah. The strength conditioning figures out the exercises. That's what we do. sport coach, your job's not also to say, I want breakfast burritos with egg whites and ham. No, that's not your position. What you got to say is, I want my athletes to have a good meal after we train. We have a sports nutritionist that decides that. So as, and this is where I feel like somebody in that unit does can do a great job sitting in the chair as a high performance director, because we know how that feels. We're able to say, you know, stand up for people in that room and say with certainty, because we've got great leadership above us, here's what we're doing. We're doing this. We're not doing a version of this. We're doing exactly this. And that's where we start creating good jobs, where coaches can keep continuing influencing student athletes, not only in performance, but in life skills. I would say start planning for that, because I think there's going to be a glut of those jobs coming up in the next.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm excited to kind of see that model start to really, you know, slide into, you know, some of the Power Five schools. As Kurt said, once a Power Five school adopts it, it's going to be like pretty much game over. Like it's on its way.
I agree. No, I agree. And, you know, listen, I'm not an idiot, right? I know that I'm at a mid-major school. We don't have football, right? So, you know, it's a little bit easier to apply that in there. Still, at the Power Five, it can be done. We're not taking away anything. Any head coach that says, well, I don't feel like I'm in charge, you know, like, well, you are in charge. You're just not in charge of strength and conditioning and sports medicine and sports nutrition. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, nothing's going to happen without you knowing about it. But you don't get to okay the fact that we power clean, or that we use muscle stim, or that we're having protein shakes with, you know, berries in it. Right? That's us. That's what we do. We take that off you. You don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a great point to end on too. Like let the different people in the hierarchy do what they do, and don't try to bleed yourself into it too much, and let them make their decisions. And I think the way you presented it in terms of like the great example of we need more vertical power. All right, well, let's let the strength coach decide how we're going to get there. I think that's a really good explanation of that kind of complex of staying in your lane or doing things the right way in terms of working with the people that are driving next to you, right? So I think that's really well said and a great way to kind of end things. So thank you for coming on. I'm, you know, it was great having you, and I think that was awesome, and a lot of stuff that I really haven't had a chance to talk in depth about yet on the show. So I really appreciate your time.
I appreciate you having me on, Jerry. You're doing a great job for the profession. Anybody who's out there disseminating information through other practitioners is only helpful.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Muscles and Management Podcast, brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jared DiFilippo, signing off on the show that's changing the way we view training, sports performance, and business.